featuring over 80 local students and guest artists from the Joffe Ballet. Tickets and information at classicaldancearts.com. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Coming up, several different interviews on today's program, including one on a beautiful National Geographic book that's just been released. Also a look at some of the extraordinary lengths to which people will go to decorate their homes for Christmas. Stay tuned. Well, for as much as I love being on the radio, the next few minutes are going to be, in some ways, a bit frustrating, maybe more frustrating for you, the listener, than for me, the host, because we're going to be talking about an absolutely extraordinary book, visually speaking, and I wish so much that
the possibility of more challenging attacks.
Some of the incredible images that are captured in this book called Rarely Seen, Photographs of the Extraordinary. It comes to us from the good folks of National Geographic, and they've produced all kinds of really astonishing work over the decades, but I don't think I have ever enjoyed a book more than this spectacular collection of some of the most amazing photographs ever taken. My guest for the next few minutes is Stephen Alvarez, who has been a photographer for National Geographic since 1995. So this serves as a lovely 20th anniversary present to himself, in a sense, although it's not just his work that appears in this beautiful work. But Stephen Alvarez has actually done his work all over the globe, and he has been selected to write the foreword for this book, in which he recounts a couple of the most important moments in his own considerable career as a photographer and photojournalist. And I am so excited about this opportunity to speak with him about his work and about this marvelous book. Again, it's called Rarely Seen, Photographs of the Extraordinary, and it is published by National Geographic. Stephen Alvarez, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, Greg, thank you for having me on this morning. It's great to talk about my career and about this book that I'm really so excited to be included in.
It's really something else. And by the way, the cover of the book includes the name Susan Tyler Hitchcock. Could you explain to us who she is and her role in putting this book together?
Well, she was the primary editor on the book, so she helped, along with a great number of other people, assembled the images and assembled how they would be structured. And it was after that process started quite a bit that they asked me to come in and write a foreword about what the photographer does and about what I've done and what the role of the photographer is at National Geographic Society, but really in society in general.
And we'll get to the book itself and some of the incredible images in just a moment. Let's find out a little bit about your own background, and let's start with where this interest in photography began for you. I mean, how far back in your life can you trace this interest?
Well, one of my first memories, Greg, is someone putting a Brownie camera in my hand when I was just a few years old and me taking my first photograph. So photography has been part of my life forever. And I knew fairly early on that I wanted to be a photographer. It wasn't until college that I really developed a sense of what that would mean. But I realized as soon as I had a camera in my hand that I could say almost anything in the world I wanted to say, and it was a great way to explore the world, and that I had something to contribute as a photographer.
Was National Geographic your first significant professional gig, or did you have significant photographic work before National Geographic 20 years ago?
I had a five-year career as a national magazine photographer before I began working for National Geographic. So I've always lived in the Southeast, and for the longest time I was the go-to photographer for a New York magazine that wanted something done below the Mason-Dixon line. So I shot a lot of portraits, a lot of editorial portraits, shot a great number of photo essays for Time and Life when it still existed, all the financial magazines. But it was National Geographic that I was always really after, because they would let a photographer explore a story in a way that I found very interesting. You know, to spend 6 months or a year on one subject is a great privilege, and it's always been my interest.
What can you tell us about the transformative nature of your work as a photographer over the last several decades, given the incredible breakthroughs in technology? And I want to ask you also about the way in which our sort of understanding and appreciation for photography has changed as well. But let's begin with your work as a photographer. In what ways has that changed the nature of what you do and how you do it?
Boy, but photography has always been a technical medium, and every advance in photography, in just the technology of photography, it leads to a different way people see. Wet plate to dry plate to glass plate to color to big format cameras to small format cameras. Each time there's a change, photography changes, and I can't believe the changes I've seen over my career. I started in film. Shooting 35-millimeter color slides, and that makes you work a certain way. Color slide film is very difficult to expose, and so much of the job there was just purely technical. If you could make a well-exposed image, that was an awful lot of skill that was involved in that, and the lighting was very different because color slide film is very slow, so I needed a lot of equipment in the field all the time. Film cameras are very fragile, so you need a lot of cameras. And the change from film to digital has been tremendously helpful for me, especially going into really remote places and photographing, say, a cave environment where it's physically very daunting to be in there. The digital technology has been fantastic for me there. The immediate feedback of what my lights are doing changes the way I work tremendously. The increased sensitivity to light changes the way I work because I need fewer lights and I can work in a much more natural and proactive fashion. So the changes in technology are astounding. Digital cameras I never saw coming, and they are just so good. They see light much more like my eyeball sees it. So it's been a huge blessing for me as a photographer.
I suppose if there's a drawback in that, it's maybe that we as the general public, perhaps to some extent, might be tempted to take photography for granted, since it's something that is sort of with us all the time, and we are forever snapping shots of this and that and selfies of ourselves and so on. Do you sense that, or is it the opposite, that in fact it opens up all of us to think about the art of photography?
Well, I think that the ubiquity of cameras now, and I'm mostly speaking about smartphone cameras, because there are so many of them, and we're all photographers now. I think that's an incredible thing, because so many people participating in photography has raised our visual literacy tremendously. As a species, we're producing an unbelievable number of photographs. I think we made a trillion images last year. However, that means that now 2 billion people are involved in photography every day, not just receiving it, but in making it. And that's a real change in how we communicate, but it's also a change in the literacy. So I find that we have a bigger audience now as photographers, because people appreciate it, an image that cuts through the clutter of the other 1 trillion images. So much.
We're speaking with...
I just think it's a great thing. It's a really exciting time to be a photographer with all these people participating in the medium.
We're speaking with Stephen Alvarez, a National Geographic photographer. He contributed a foreword, and several of his wonderful photographs are part of an amazing new book from National Geographic called Rarely Seen, Photographs of the Extraordinary. You begin your foreword by talking about a couple of the most intriguing experiences which you have had as a photographer, including in 2006 an expedition to a very remote part of New Guinea in the South Pacific, in which you entered an absolutely amazing cave. And for you, it sounds like it helped crystallize for you the purpose of the kind of photography that you do. Tell our listeners about this experience.
Yes, in 2006, I was part of an expedition to the island of New Britain in Papua New Guinea. So really the opposite pole, part of the world from where I am now. And what we wanted to do on this expedition was explore a number of caves that had never seen much visitation. And I've always loved this idea as of photographer as explorer. And we found a cave room that was very, very difficult to get to. It was almost a 12-hour trip to get to the room itself. You had to go down a rift and swim up a river, all in complete darkness. And the room itself is extraordinary. 4-acre emerald green lake, 120-foot golden ceilings, 30-foot waterfall on one side, and then passages way back that are just extraordinary to see. And to be there as a photographer and realize that more people have stood on the surface of the moon than have been in this cave room, is just being there is extraordinary. But then to make the image that carries that experience back to a general public is that's really the role of the photographer, is to go into the world and either see something new like we had seen there, something that no one had ever discovered before, or see something in a new way and explain that. And that's what I've always thought our role is to go out into the world and interpret it, either by through its newness or through its through just looking at things differently.
Hmm. In your foreword, and by the way, one of the most spectacular pictures you took on that photographic exhibition immediately follows your foreword, and it is a jaw-dropping photograph indeed. You also mention in the foreword an incredible privilege you were granted by entering, in a sense, one of the most restricted places on Earth, another cave, a very, very famous cave, but nevertheless a cave no one ever gets to see, but you got to see it and you got to photograph it. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, A lot of times at National Geographic, the images are the product of tremendous and long planning. And we had decided to do a story about the first artists. And it was really a story about why people started making art. And one of the things I knew I wanted to photograph were the oldest figurative paintings on Earth, or some of the oldest. And they're in a cave called Chauvet in southern France. And Chauvet, as you said, is one of the most restricted places on Earth. The French government is very serious about the conservation of this cave because the paintings are 36 millennia old, and they don't want to mess them up. So it took 2 years of asking and begging and pleading with the Ministry of Culture in France to finally get access to the cave. And in the end, they gave me 6 hours. So they said, you can go. You will take 3 trips of 2 hours each. And the place is, I don't think Fort Knox is as well guarded as Chauvet is. You actually enter through a submarine door that's been bolted onto the side of the mountain. And it's, but you step inside a time capsule. And inside this cave, eons melt away. And standing in front of those paintings, it is a mind-boggling experience, because here on the wall are paintings that are very well preserved, and the artist, who's been dead for 36 millennium, is speaking as clearly to you as if they were standing in the same room. And that compression of time is, and that feeling of history is just tremendous. And to be able to make images in there that in some way transmit that experience is a tremendous privilege. Mm.
And if we turn to page 204 in this book, we see at least one of the incredible photographs which you took on that day. And we share your sense of wonder, even though we are only, in a sense, secondhand visitors to that place. Explain to our listeners how this book is put together.
The book is put together by chapter, and what we've done is broken it out to phenomena, life, places, objects, and moments. And of course, there's some overlap in between them, but the idea was to have things grouped by, you know, what they are, and to give some sense to it that way. And each of the images is accompanied by a extended caption in that the photographers all contributed to. So you not only get to see the image, but in some way the thoughts of the photographer when they were capturing it.
Do you have any particular favorites that you want to mention?
Well, I'm looking at page 52 right now, and the image is called Cries of Nature. And what it is a photograph of lava and an ash cloud and lightning all at once. And it's from a volcano in Japan. And it's one of the most extraordinary images in the book. It's just a showstopper because it's so dramatic. And I know that we wouldn't be able to, you know, no one gets to see that. No one gets to stand that close to a volcano and experience that moment when the volcano is erupting and lightning is coming out of the ash cloud. Very, very few people on Earth have ever seen it, and even fewer have lived to tell about it. So to have that image and to be able to experience that is really what the book is all about, to be able to experience these things that you wouldn't be able to otherwise.
Right. I think a very good example of that is a really neat full color spread of 138 skydivers high above Chicago, Illinois. And of course, that is not only a sight that none of us or most of us will never see ourselves, but it's also a sight that in a sense only exists for a split second. And a photographer captured that for us, and we have it forever.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that's in the moment section. So that's the perfect example of something that only exists for a fleeting instant, but the photograph makes it live forever. The other image that I find extraordinary in the book is the image of the fireflies on the forest floor.
Yes.
Because that photograph, it's a time exposure, so you get a sense of this river of light moving through the forest. And it's very true to the experience of standing in a forest full of fireflies, but it's a way of seeing it that doesn't exist without the photo, without the picture.
Right. And, of course, many beautiful images of the wonders of nature are captured here as well. A man's face-to-face encounter with an elephant underwater, beautiful pictures of tulips growing in Belgium, and on and on. It's just an amazing book. I cannot remember enjoying a book start to finish the way I enjoyed this collection, again called Rarely Seen, Photographs of the Extraordinary, published by National Geographic, with a foreword by Stephen Alvarez, whose photographic work is also represented in this book. Stephen Alvarez, thank you so much for joining me today on the morning show to offer a word about this really, really beautiful book. I appreciate this.
Well, thank you so much, Greg. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
The time is 8:31, and you're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha Racine, Elkhorn and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. Part two of the Morning Show is coming up in just a moment. I hope some of you remember from a few months ago an interview that I did with a guy named Bruce Littlefield about a really entertaining book called Garage Sale America. In that book, Bruce Littlefield talked of his experience of really crisscrossing the country, visiting all kinds of famous garage sales and flea markets and so on. And a book with text and pictures that just really took us right into the heart of that experience. And now with the Christmas holiday right around the corner, we have another book by Bruce Littlefield, very much of the same ilk, called Merry Christmas, America, Megawatt Displays Across the USA. And he really helps us celebrate and maybe understand a little bit what seems to be popping up in communities all across the country, this phenomenon of people going out of their way and maybe devoting nearly all of their extra time and energy and funds to creating these enormous and spectacular Christmas displays in front of their homes or businesses. It's amazing, and especially when you see some of the most dramatic examples of that gathered together in the pages of one book. And that's what we're going to talk about for the next few minutes. The book, again, called Merry Christmas, America, Megawatt Displays Across the USA. It's published by Collins Design, an imprint of HarperCollins. And Bruce Littlefield, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Why, thank you, Greg. Thanks for having me again.
Good to have you here. I mean, I think the main reason people are going to pick up this book is to look at these incredible photographs of these incredible Christmas displays. Just ahead of that, though, I would love to have you kind of talk to our listeners a little bit about some of the history that you explain at the front of the book.
Sure.
About when this whole business of electric lights was first created.
Yes.
I was astonished to read how early this was developed.
Pretty amazing, right? 1882. It was created by a guy named Edward Johnson, who was the partner of Thomas Edison. And, you know, he decided that he'd like to add something to his Christmas tree in his Fifth Avenue apartment, and he created 80 red, white, and blue, like walnut-sized lights for his Christmas tree and invited his friends over. And as I say in the book, Christmas was dark nevermore.
Hmm.
It was the beginning of what is now a phenomenon. As you said that people go out of their way to decorate, and I say they go over the top. You know,
yeah.
It's like they really climb on their houses and really go for it.
Well, and it's like in a way that it was not, let's say, 50 years ago, it's like this concerted effort I mean, in which they sit down and plan. I mean, it isn't just the kind of, it's not just one more thing they do during the holidays. I mean, for many people, it's the central thing they do during the holidays.
And it's one of the themes of their year. I mean, literally, so many of the people that I talk to in the book plan their Christmas displays all year long because they feel that they are, what they're doing is their gift to their community. And, you know, when you see the kids or the folks that show up in front of these displays, you realize that they are indeed doing something that is a community service, something that is going to brighten other people's lives.
Let's back up to the history for just another moment. As you mentioned, we can look in 1882 for the first electric lights on a Christmas tree. You tell us 1895 was when the first time an electrically lit Christmas tree was displayed at the White House. And you suggest that this really had impact for the country. I mean, this is what really paved the way for this to be a part of many Americans' lives.
Well, it did. Grover Cleveland started the tradition at the White House. And you know what's interesting that I found interesting about that was that during that time, it was the very high society that had their Christmas trees. In fact, the Christmas tree, to have a lighted Christmas tree in that time period, which was the late 1800s, was about a $300 expense. So you can imagine how expensive that was in the late 1800s to spend $300.
That would be thousands and thousands
thousands
of dollars.
Exactly. I mean, and you know, I mean, to spend $300 now on a tree is a lot of money. So, I mean, it was real high society. And then by the 1920s, General Electric had come out, and I think it was actually 1902, a Ladies Home Journal ad came out, and they had they were selling Christmas lights, General Electric. And by 1920, they decided that they were going to sponsor around the country, like decorating with color light contests. So they had newspapers that participated all across the country, and each family in the country began to want to have their Christmas tree lit.
You talk in the book about over the many years, I think these are maybe your childhood years, although I'm not absolutely certain, about a neighborhood Christmas decorating contest and how you were always hoping for first place and it just never quite came your way.
Never quite happened. Still hasn't happened. But, you know, it started when I think I was about 13 and my neighborhood decided to have their own decorating contest. And the prize wasn't anything but a sign that says you were the best in the neighborhood. And I remember it being this cute little sign with red letters, and it said, you know, best house. And I wanted to be the best house. That first year, my dad worked at the local nylon plant, and he had some flawed nylon, red nylon. And I literally took that nylon and tried to wrap our house to look like a present. And and my dad still talks about that was the year that I rendered the front door completely useless. But the joy of that moment was that instead of winning the contest, I got my picture in the paper as the kid who, quote, tried to wrap his house. And so it became every year another attempt for me to try to win the decorating contest.
So when you set about to write this book and to visit some of these incredible sights of Christmas decorating gone over the top, I mean, this is like returning to the mothership for you.
Yes, and to get in my marching orders, my instructions, I literally thought, well, I want to see how these people do it and why they do it. Because, you know, you heard my reason. I wanted to be the guy who was the best in the neighborhood. But all the people around the country that do this in such a large, over-the-top way, they do it for particular reasons. Like, in Florida, I found a woman whose young daughter passed away when the daughter was 8 years old. She died right before Christmas. She loved the Christmas, going to see Christmas lights. And instead of the family, you know, just being distraught, they decided to make something out of it. And they took her the stand at the funeral for the flowers. It was a little tripod stand. They took it home, put it in the center of their yard, and wrapped lights around it. and made it as sort of a memorial to their daughter. Well, 18 years later, they still do it, but that little Christmas tree is still in the center of their yard, and it's surrounded by just, you know, a whole collection of incredible, beautiful Christmas things.
Hmm.
And in each family that I met have their reason for doing it.
Another, right. You know, I think that's one of the things that's striking about the book, because I think for anybody who looks at this and thinks, oh my gosh, there's something kind of sick about this, or this seems like, I mean, maybe a holly jolly addiction.
Yes.
There are certain stories that might confirm those fears, and then other stories in this book in which it really seems like there is something more laudable going on here, and
yeah.
that for some people it really is an effort to bring joy to their own lives and the lives of others.
Exactly. You know, I tell the story in the book, and there's in Seattle, there's a place called Candy Cane Lane, and it was started in the early 50s by a guy that was a Japanese internment camp survivor. And when he, after the war, when he was released, he went back to Seattle, and in order to show that his spirit and love for our country was still strong, he created a passion scene in his yard, and it was very well received. And the following Christmas, he had enjoyed the previous reception so much that he began to create things for his neighbors, and he created one by one a little candy canes made out of stovepipe, and that he hand-painted and made very special. Well, by, you know, 10 years later, the entire street, a little cul-de-sac, had begun to have decorations on their house, and now it is truly one of the Seattle institution. I had gone there in the late 70s with my aunt and remembered it fondly, and then last year I got to go again, and it is still going strong, and it's sort of one of those acts of community cooperation that just really makes you feel good about being an American.
Hmm. You tell a real interesting story that I think of what turned out to be a real surprise for you, because let's face it, 90% of what we see are candy canes and elves and gingerbread men and Santa and Rudolph and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And of course, for many people, that embodies Christmas as much as anything. And then there are other people where, of course, all of that is beside the central point of why there even is a holiday called Christmas. You ended up meeting a family at some point, I think, during your travels through North Carolina.
Yes.
And the father turned out to be a Baptist minister.
Yes, and in fact, I was shooting in their front yard. They weren't home, and he came home, and they realized that I was, you know, in love with their display. And it wasn't anything outrageous. It was really just a little small tree in their yard, and they had done the edge of their house. But it was, you could tell that a certain love went into doing what they did. And he said, listen, I want to take you somewhere. I want to take you to my favorite house, which a lot of the families did want to share their favorite. Even though they had their own display, they wanted to share their favorite house with me. And he took me to this house that truly, it was like Clark Griswold from the movie Vacation lived there. Every square inch of the house was covered in Christmas lights. And as we stood outside, he said, it's amazing, isn't it? And I said, oh, it really, really is. And he said, and I said, well, can you, you know, tell me what you think about Christmas and what the meaning of Christmas is? And he said, well, I'm a Baptist minister, and I know the meaning of Christmas. But then he began to tell me that besides the you know, the story of Jesus's birth, that it also had other incredible meanings to him, which is that it was, you know, of course the spirituality of Christmas is a part of it, but it was that the Christmas evokes sort of a magical feeling of the wonder of life, and whether it be children or older people, that it's a magic that makes us feel awestruck. And as he sort of drove away, and I thought, you know, it really is, Christmas is a time that we're able to tell the people that we that we care about, that we love them without feeling all sappy. You know, we're able to give them a gift and to say, hey, I really care about you. And it just feels right, you know. And I think in particularly these, you know, sort of sad and hard times, we're faced every day with bad news coming at us from all angles. I think Christmas time is one of those times that our life can be lightened and brightened.
Well, and that's certainly what you're told by this guy named Jerry Weingarten and his home, which is all but encased in lights. I mean, not just you know, the outlines that we're used to seeing in windows, but I mean, it's practically solid lights.
And, yeah, every square inch.
And he doesn't get very specific, or at least you don't share any specifics with us, but he touches on this on having experienced some darkness, he and his family, and how this is one of their ways to say they're not giving in to the darkness that has been part of their lives.
Yeah, he told me some, you know, a really hard story that his family had gone through a really hard time. And instead of just dwelling in their sadness and their, you know, the hardship, he decided that he would take to his house and put some little, you know, throw some Christmas around. You know, that song from Mame, "We Need a Little Christmas," right this very minute. And that's what he felt like. And so he took to his house, and as the lights went up, he began to realize that his spirits brightened. And the more he did, the happier he became. And he said, I can't remember if I used this in the book, but he said, well, we can't wash our clothes during the Christmas season because our power will go out.
Oh, dear.
We're certainly a happy family now.
Interesting. One thing that I think is probably worth maybe just touching on, I mean, sometimes you're showing us pictures of homes where it looks like, I mean, these people know something about decorating, and then we'll see other pictures and we'll think these people probably know nothing about decorating. And I think that's kind of an interesting thing too, how for some people they appear to be guided by kind of, you know, an artistic vision. Yep. And then there are others who just seem to be doing not much more than just kind of piling it on, I mean, to extraordinary length, and yet, you know, it's a free country and it's their home, and but it's just fascinating to see the difference in the ways people can go about doing this.
Well, it's funny, Greg. I say that, you know, you like vanilla, I like chocolate. You say tomato, I say tomato. You know, it's like people do have a different vision of what Christmas spectacle should be, and some people do it, and it's you know, for my taste, it's stunningly beautiful. And other people do it, and it's outrageously hilarious. And whatever they do, I've actually had a good time experiencing their vision of it. You know, some of the quote-unquote over-the-top tacky, self-described tacky decorators enjoy that and enjoy being the sort of plastic yard, you know.
They have no illusions of it being anything else. I mean,
no,
they don't presume to think that this is beautiful, what they've done.
Yeah, well, they think there's beauty in the tackiness.
Right. Or it's about being spectacular.
Well, exactly, certainly.
As you met these people, how much did you have a sense that at least in some cases, this is something gone amok a little bit? I mean, that it is somebody with kind of an insatiable addiction, and you know, maybe people that are devoting time and energy and money that, you know, could be putting food on someone's table or whatever. I mean,
well,
how much did you wrestle with that?
You know what? I have to be honest with you. I didn't wrestle with that at all. I found that the people that I met were so joyful. They were so excited about what they were doing that I could only think that it was manifesting well in the rest of their life. People that would stop at these houses and see such, you know, outrageous displays, their lives were lifted. And you know that old saying, when you give, you get? I think that for the people that decorated, to stand from their perspective in their living rooms, to look out their windows and to see all of those people getting such joy, in their front yards, you can't help but think that that's going to, you know, manifest well in their lives.
Hmm.
So I didn't have anything but really joyful experiences to watch. And the one common thread that I found in all the people that I met was that they were all kind, very kind souls.
Hmm. You also talk, and this actually surprised me, that you've already touched on certain neighborhoods. I mean, right here in Kenosha, we have a similar sort of neighborhood called Christmas Lane, where essentially every single house for a couple of city blocks spectacularly decorates their homes and yards, and it's something that people come from miles around to see, and it speaks of kind of a cooperation. And then you'll show us other pictures in which we'll have one spectacular thing, yeah, and then more normal houses next door. But you paint a picture of often where the neighbors don't seem to mind very much.
Yes, it's true. You know, some of the neighborhoods seem to pay sort of homage to the person that is their star attraction. So they might, for example, in Richmond, one house that actually the cover of my book, that house is sort of the star attraction in that Mechanicsville, Virginia neighborhood. But the neighbors all line their road with little candy canes or lights or things that sort of direct you to the main event. And the neighbors will sit in their driveways and talk to people at night, and they sort of revel in it. So, you know, it's the kind of thing that the people in the neighborhoods that aren't all decorated do try to celebrate the person that is decorated.
Hmm. Do you end up having one single favorite?
Yes, I do. You know, and it's hard to pick favorites, but one guy touched me and just really made me happy to talk to him. And he's a guy that creates everything in his yard he hand makes, and his name is Al Thompson, and he is an affable guy. He and his wife never were able to have children, and he had a love of going to a Christmas house as a child, and he remembered the joy of it, and he asked his wife if they could, you know, decorate their house in an outrageous way so that the kids could enjoy it. And they do it with such glee. And I was there one night when an elderly nursing home tour group, a bus, pulled up in front of his yard. And he asked me if I wanted to climb on the bus with him while he talked to everyone. And when he climbed on that bus, it was as if, you know, a major celebrity had climbed aboard. those people cheered him and were so excited. These, you know, 80 and 90-year-olds were 8 and 9-year-olds. They were brought back to, you know, children. And he was hilarious. He began sort of going through what the display how much effort it took and what it takes. He said, you know, it's 400 hours to put it up and 150 hours to take it down. And then he sort of counted out that there are 425 extension cords and 80 plugs and 40 breakers. And he went through this whole list. And when he finished, he goes, the bus just cheered. And he said, is there any other questions? He basically told him everything. He said, is there any other questions? And you can't believe almost every hand on the bus shot up with questions. They were so excited. It was like school kids being there. It was just wonderful. So that's one of my favorite memories, is talking to him.
Hmm. I realize I neglected to ask you how you found these people. I mean, obviously, it's not hard. In some ways, it's not hard to find a house that's covered with spectacular Christmas decorations. But, I mean, yeah, actually, in some ways, it can be a little bit tricky in larger cities and so on, but how did you end up connecting with the people who's decorating you picture and talk about in the book?
Good, very good question. I started, I knew of a few displays around the country. Like I said, I knew of Seattle's Candy Cane Lane. I knew that Newport Beach in California does an annual boat parade, which is spectacular. I knew from my friend in Colorado that Denver does a great botanical garden display, and I knew from my friend in Austin that Austin has a Trail of Lights that's incredible. And so I started talking to all my friends that I know about what they like to go see at Christmas around the country. So that was one way. And then I remembered from my childhood that Richmond, Virginia did this thing called the Tacky Light Tour, and I decided that I would start there. Because I knew that it would be a concentrated area of a lot of lights, and because they do this list in the paper. And so I began there. But each of the people that I went, the houses that I went to, they would tell me about their favorite places, or have you heard about, or did you see? And I kept great notes. And then in the four-week period that I was traveling, I literally would change my plans based on what people said, and would journey to I tried to hit a city a night, but in some towns I stayed two or three nights.
Hmm.
And it was amazing, truly amazing.
And of course, people who do this are typically not shy. I mean, I should think actually it probably wasn't much of an issue in terms of them welcoming your particular sort of attention.
Well, it's funny. People want to talk about what they love to do, and especially if you the interviewer love it too, you know. And so I tried not to call ahead too much, because I didn't want people to sort of change what their normal routine was. But if I were, like, when I flew out to Seattle, I did call ahead out there to make sure. But people literally would allow, you know, these are the people in the country who are still neighborly, so you could knock on their door and they would come out into their lawn and they would tell me about their display. And how much more American and friendly can you get than that? That is pretty darn great.
Mm. The book again is called Merry Christmas America, Megawatt Displays Across the USA. And it has, by the way, at the end, a real interesting list that goes state by state and some places in all across the country where you can go see particularly spectacular things. And there are some things listed there, including places in Waukesha and Milwaukee that should be sought out. And maybe if this book ever gets republished, we'll make sure that Kenosha's Christmas Lane sneaks on the list as well.
I wrote it down as you were talking about it.
Again, the book is published by HarperCollins and Bruce Littlefield. What a wonderful job you've done in putting this delightful book together. And I'm glad we could talk about it today on the morning show. Best wishes to you and happy holidays.
Thank you, Greg. Ho, ho, ho.
On Monday's morning show, I look forward to having a conversation with Mark Darling and Linda Bennett from the Studio of Classical Dance Arts in Racine. Their production of Tchaikovsky's The Nutcracker is coming up next weekend at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and I look forward very much to speaking with them on Monday's morning show. On Tuesday, I'll be speaking with author Peter Navarro about a very intriguing book of his called Crouching Tiger, What China's Militarism Means for the World. Mr. Navarro has taken a close look at the many ways in which China has recently built up its military capabilities in some very striking and disconcerting ways. On Wednesday, we will be talking about the Racine Theater Guild's production of the musical Mary Poppins, which opens tonight. Mary Poppins flies in this production. We'll be talking with the actress portraying her, Jamie Johnson, and also talking with artistic director Doug Instanis on Wednesday. Next Thursday, we'll meet the new executive director of the Racine Dominican Eco-Justice Center. And 1 week from today, I will be replaying a conversation with Sam Chell about the great Frank Sinatra in anticipation of Frank Sinatra's 100th birthday, which would be Saturday the 12th. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Sunshine, now through next Wednesday, and very mild conditions. Today's high 49 degrees, overnight low of 30. Tomorrow's high now is forecast to be 53 degrees. We will see daytime highs in the mid-40s Sunday through Tuesday, and actually temperatures warming up again close to 50 by the middle of next week. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and